What I should like to do first is give you a small demonstration with my numerical stellar dynamics code as to what these three terms we're talking about are basically implying. Now, I have chosen a situation which is spherically symmetric, and therefore we can expect that in the fullness of time, the term over here, the T term, will be relatively unimportant. The term on the left-hand side, the time derivative, is going to be dominant, of course. At first, I've chosen an initial situation where you have a spherical distribution of stars, where the stars are put down randomly with a slight bias towards the center, and we're going to see what happens. Now, in some of the examples in the book, some of the figures, the authors have used 50,000 stars. This is only 600. And in the case of 50,000 stars, they have imposed a slight inhomogeneity on the system. I did not have to do that in this particular case because Poisson statistics is already sufficient in generating local inhomogeneities, doubles, triples, etc., of stars. Another thing that I have done, as you may just see it over here, is I've marked one of the stars with a different color so that you could see how an individual object behaves under the influence of the overall behavior of the system. Now, if you start the time, I've started the initial velocities in such a way that we are approximately 20% in velocity below the energy equipartition. And therefore, for at first, this term over here, this pressure term, is rather smaller than this one over here. And we will see the consequences, because if you start a time, then you will see that everything basically starts to fall towards the center. So if you were to stop after a little bit, you will see that this individual star here, you're just following something that you might more or less expect. You can already see from the spacing of the dots that this is almost like a Keplerian orbit, right? At the apocenter here, the steps are very small. At the pericenter over here, the stars accelerated near the center. And all the time, of course, it is orbiting in a changing potential, right? So this W term over here, you can already see changes very drastically because the central concentration of this system over here is already very much bigger than the central concentration was at the moment we started. That is why I have chosen only a relatively modest bias for the initial mass distribution towards the center. If we allow time to continue, you will see something interesting happen. Just a moment ago, the central concentration over here was rather bigger than what it is here. So you see a core bounce. You see that the stars fall towards the center and then they bounce off again. And this is something that, again, is reminiscent of what we know from ordinary gas dynamics. All right. If you make something, if you have a sound wave, as it were, moving towards a central point, it bounces off and it expands again. Right. So that is what we see here. This front almost, this outer perimeter of the stars over here, just simply starts to move out again because of this core bounce. And if we were to continue this, you see it proceed. And a lot of the stars now find their way back towards the periphery. So again, this cloud is rather bigger now and almost as big as it started. However, something has happened to the overall distribution. The central concentration now is very much bigger than what it used to be before. So you have seen here in front of your eyes that the rapid change of the potential term over here has induced a change in the random distribution of the velocities of the stars. That just simply heated up the gas, as it were, which is why you have this core halo structure now. Okay, this is something that is concentrated, and you will see that by and large these stars will be moving out, and a non-negligible fraction of them is already on the way to infinity at the moment we are looking. Another way in which you can see the effect of the change of the potential, you will notice when looking at the orbit of that individual star that I've marked, you've noticed that in the beginning, during the motion, it really rather closely resembled a Keplerian orbit. And if you were to stop this over here at one particular point, you will see that this is perhaps also the case here. But you have segments, as it were, of elliptical orbits that are sort of glued together. And definitely, this is not Keplerian in the sense that this orbit is certainly not in a plane. Why is it not in a plane? Just simply because of this drastic change of the potential over here has thrown it out of kilter. Right. Effectively, this is what happens to all the stars, even though I've marked just a single one over here, and it looks just by coincidence, I mean, I didn't plan it in this way, that this star is sufficiently close to the center that it remains bound, whereas had I taken one that was really rather further out, it would possibly have followed some of these fellows over here. See how fast this one is going, for instance. That is definitely on its way to infinity. So if one were to reduce the size of this a little bit, no, this is a factor two smaller than I started out with. The core halo structure is really rather more clear. The situation now is that we are approaching, due to just simply time going on, we're approaching a situation that is really rather similar to what you would get if the left-hand term over here would disappear. Now, why would that disappear? Why would that change? That is because the spatial distribution, the x sub k over there, and the velocity distribution, the mean velocities that you see in those terms here, have been mixed up in such a way that the total of them has become more or less time independent. And while I was chattering away over here, you've seen the whole thing move, and zooming back in again on where we started, you will definitely recognize in the random motion of these stars over here something that is really rather more like a thermal system. And again, the orbit of that individual star that we have been following all the time is all an exponent of this particular term over here, this pressure term. It is this pseudo-pressure. It is not pressure in the sense of a gas where the particles are physically colliding with each other, but it is a pressure in the dynamical sense. It is this pressure that holds up the system as a whole. Another thing that you will notice over here is that the spacing between the steps of these individual stars that we're following here is rather bigger than it was when we started the computation. And there again, that is a consequence of the fact that it is just simply moving faster. In other words, this P term over here has increased, right? So we see this effectively in front of our eyes. Going back again to the situation we had more or less before, if you were to just simply leave this for the next half hour computation time or something thereabouts, you would not really see anything that changes very drastically. All right, so you just simply see this pressure wave going out, and that pressure wave is similar to a sound wave traveling through a gas, and that induces such a change in this potential term over here that this thing now becomes very large. Had I not taken a system that was initially spherically symmetric, but something, for instance, that was a rotating disk or something thereabouts, then, of course, this term here, the systematic streaming, would also come into play. But I've deliberately chosen things in such a way that that is not relevant in order to make things a little bit simpler. All right, then. So much for the little demo. I hope that you yourself were able to transplant this particular image to what you would see in an actual galaxy, in an actual place, a piece of the sky, in an actual telescope. What remains to do now is go effectively back and start talking about the original form of the Boltzmann equation with a non-vanishing left-hand side. And following the book, I intend to do this in several steps. One is, I will give you a little bit of background as to where that term is supposed to come from. Then I will talk a little bit about possible global ways of treating this. And then, and that will happen next week, we should be in a position to look in a little bit more detail in what is actually happening in an actual practical case. Now, let us then go back to what we had before. What we had before was effectively an equation of this form. something like this. We should replace this over here. VI over here. Okay. Now, I've removed all the periphery here to go back to what we started out originally. And now I'm going to do something yet again. We used to have this equal to zero, and we're going to change this all. We're going to put something, some driving term, something on the left-hand side of that equation. So we now sort of restore everything to what it used to be before. We had the following expression, that the time rate of change of the distribution function, being a function of position, velocity, and time, effectively is composed of a gradient term in space times the streaming velocity, times a transportation velocity, plus this df by dv. And again, I should have abstracted from the various indices to make things a little bit clearer. This used to be zero, but we can't really keep that anymore if we have a so-called collision term. Now, the reason it's called a collision term is that this theory hails from the theory of kinetic theory of gases. And there we know that the objects that make up the gas, the atoms of the molecules, physically collide, and that is why this is called the collision term. We have kept this term in the case of stellar dynamics, even though you have already seen that physical collisions between stars are vanishingly rare. Now, let us consider for a moment, by going back to what this F actually means, to what this collision term could possibly be like. And in a previous sketch thereof, I have already mentioned a little bit of this, and may I remind you of it. Now, that goes approximately as follows. Again, I'm sort of collapsing things to one dimension, but you get my drift. The distribution function tells you something about the probability of finding stars with a particular position and a particular velocity. If the subgrid model, that is to say, what happens inside this box, is of a certain property, then we can say we neglect what happens on the left. But, of course, we cannot really do this all the time. And let me remind you of the way in which this is going in the case of the streaming of a gas. That goes like this. Suppose you have a particle on a phase orbit over here and another particle on another phase orbit. And the phase orbit itself, of course, is determined by a lot of external circumstances such as this acceleration and other possible situation. Now, in the original theory by Boltzmann, the hypothesis was that at one particular location in space, the particles physically collide, just boink against each other like billiard balls. They jump to another velocity at the same position. That's what happens during a collision. And when one velocity goes down, the other is likely to go up because of energy conservation and all that. And then they continue on a different phase path. Now, you may recall that almost everything we have been using over here in terms of conservation laws, conservation of mass, conservation of momentum, density, etc., including things like Jeans' theorem and the Virial theorem, hinged on the assumption that what goes into a phase cell also goes out. So this continuity of streaming in phase space is something that we translated into continuity of momentum density, energy density, etc., etc. And that, for instance, today gave us the Virial theorem. When you have a collision, this is no longer the case. You have a discontinuity. And that discontinuity is put on the left-hand side in this collision term. It turned out that doing things in this way, in the case of gas dynamics, was an extremely powerful tool. an extremely powerful way of doing things. Just point contacts between particles, right? However, we know that this cannot be maintained. The so-called Boltzmann approach, the Boltzmann collision term, that effectively is an algebraic variant of what we have sketched on the blackboard over here, cannot no longer be maintained for the simple reason that stars do not physically collide. And you might say, now look, you know, that doesn't really matter very much because the subgrid model over here could still allow us to do this. But in the very first paragraphs of the textbook, it was already explained that this is just simply a non-starter. The characteristic length scale of star-star interactions is so large that it will just simply not qualify as a good subgrid model. Therefore, we need to do something else. And that something else, in fact, already also existed in the literature before stellar dynamics became the vogue. And that is associated with the Fokker-Planck approximation. And that goes as follows. It is, in a sense, similar to the Boltzmann collision term, except it takes a different side, as it were, of the approximation. Whereas the Boltzmann term allows particles with very different velocities to collide at one given location in space, the Fokker-Planck approximation does something else. You start particles on relatively nearby phase orbits. You connect them with later phase orbits, but you do this in a very gradual fashion. So the change in velocity is smeared out over a broad range of positions, and you make certain that the change is not really very big. All right. You can see that this is much more useful in the case of stellar dynamics. The range of star-star encounters, of a hyperbolic star-star encounter, technically speaking, mathematically speaking, is infinite. So you might want to make this infinitely large. Well, you know that in a practical case, we're dealing with a galaxy, which is a low sort of aggregate of stuff in space with a certain characteristic size, and therefore imposing a finite size on this interaction is not too implausible, as it were. And you also know that the vast majority of encounters between stars are going to be very distant, and therefore the deflection on their path is going to be very modest. All right. And that means that this particular approximation is the one of choice if we wanted to design a collision term on the left-hand side of our stellar dynamics Boltzmann equation. That is then, formally speaking, called the Fokker-Planck equation, but that is something that will not be elaborated here very much. Rather than diving straight away into the algebra behind this, let me give you, for the conclusion of today, just one example which is really rather pretty, and it is one page in the book. So please, again, do not follow the writing, but just bear with me. It starts all the way at the bottom of page 557. It is section E in chapter 7, and it is basically in anticipation of what I already said about binaries. If you were to look at your typical distribution in phase space, I've already in the course of this lecture series given you some examples thereof, you will find that phase space is sort of filled more or less like this. You know, of course, that the harmonic oscillator is just an ellipse in this thing, so this is a series of harmonic oscillators would look like this. Now, let us imagine that somewhere outside the centroid of this galaxy you have a binary star. Then that means that you have something that is an orbit like this in phase space, and that could be very far out of the energy envelope of the galaxy, which means that somewhere over here, at the periphery where the velocities are small, sort of this is far away from the center, so it's in the halo, and therefore the velocities are small, that this, in interaction with this particular system over here, would heat things up right? I mean, the extent is very large in velocity. In random velocity, you know that it's equivalent to having a very high temperature, very high energy per particle. Now, where would those binaries come from? To connect this with this collision behavior that I've been talking about, let us follow what the book says on page 557, etc. Then you get some reasonably good impression as to how this works. You know from basic Newtonian theory that a two-body encounter is energy conserving and therefore can never form a binary. However, it is possible for a third object to come by and somehow interact with the other stars and form a binary. And let us see what scalar estimates we can give. Now, the velocity perturbation that you get in any encounter, delta V, is of the order of G times M, okay, the gravitational constant times the mass, divided by the distance, the impact parameter, okay, of the encounter, and the velocity over here. Or, in other words, you will find that delta V over V, the relative change of velocity, is of the order of what they call B sub 90, called B perpendicular over B. By the way, just a slight pedantic remark, technically speaking, the most probable deflection for something like this is not 90 degrees, but 1 radian, all right, which is rather less than 90 degrees, but it doesn't really matter for the estimate. So where this B perpendicular is GM over V squared, the impact parameter for something that gives you an approximate 90 degree deflection of your stars. Now, the nice thing about this is that you can then ask for two joint probabilities. One is something where you have a change, where this is of the order of unity. That is to say, you change the orbital energy of the star by something that is comparable to the orbital energy it has already. And you can ask yourself what the probability is that you have three stars together in the same box of space, where the box of space size is given approximately by this quantity over here. Right? So when does it happen that in a large galaxy this occurs? And the interesting thing is that you see already that this is going to be a function of the velocity distribution. This is something easy to understand, because if the velocity distribution, the velocities are very large, then of course the deflection is going to be very small. If the system is very hot, all right, then the encounter between particles doesn't change a particle very much in its orbit. Now, the time interval between these encounters you can compute, because you know what the velocity is and you know how much space is going to travel. In the book, in the middle of page 558, they then argue that the time interval, okay, between such encounters is approximately given by 1 over the spatial density times this B perpendicular all squared, all right, times the velocity. And there again, this is something that you will readily understand, because, of course, this is none other than a time expression of the mean free path of the particles. We know that the mean free path is inversely proportional to the spatial density and inversely proportional to the targets that you have. Okay, the target size is proportional to the square of the radial size, right? So this is none other than the mean free path expressed in terms of time rather than in terms of mean free path, which brings this velocity in here. So if you include this, the time between two encounters, and you ask yourself what happens if you have three, then of course you have a similar product factor that comes in over here, and the authors then say that the time for a triple encounter is of the order of, and I'm just quoting from them from here, V to the power 9, believe it or not, divided by N squared, okay, times G to the fifth. That G is an interesting, of course, it's equal to unity for a real physicist, times M to the 5. Okay, cool. The large powers that you have over here for this velocity come in because you require three things coming together. So it's a conditional probability, which, of course, as you know, multiplies. The next thing they invoke is they make an estimate of V squared for the entire stellar system. And this is something that we now have seen before. Because you will recall that in the tensorvirial theorem, we had 2k plus w. And that means that we can make an immediate estimate of the k term, that is the energy, and therefore the velocity distribution of the stars, just plain simply from the potential of the whole system. Well, the potential of the whole system is fairly straightforward. And therefore, you can find that V squared is approximately equal to, I'm just copying from the book, times G times N times M. NM is the total mass of the galaxy, of course, the total number of stars times the mass of an individual star, divided by the size of the galaxy, right? If then ultimately you put everything in, you get the following situation, that the time for a triple encounter divided by the relaxation time, which you get from the from this quantity over here, is approximately, and I'm again quoting from the book, 10. The number 10 just simply comes out when you work out the G's and the B's and things like that, right? So for M, you take a typical stellar mass, and for G, you take the ordinary value of the gravitational constant. And when you do that, you find 10 N squared log N. All right. They just simply use this number. It's just an estimate. You could compute the second decimal if you wanted to, but sort of that order of magnitude. That means then that if you work this out, that the total number of binary triples, okay, triple encounters per your relaxation time, the total number of triple encounters per relaxation time, and therefore also the total number of binary stars that could be formed, all right, is given by the following quantity, N times T relaxation divided by T sub 3. So this T3 encounter that we saw over there times is approximately equal to 0.1 over N log N, where N is the total number of stars. You might say, well, it's just a matter of waiting, right? How many relaxation times should I wait? However, on the other hand, as we had already seen in the little computer demo that I gave to you, a typical stellar system evaporates. The outer parts are unbound because of what happens in the core. All right, so there's this trade-off between the W term and the pi term in the tensorvirial theorem. That means that if this quantity N here, the total number of stars in the system, is substantially larger than something of the order of 10 or thereabouts, 10, 20, the probability that during the lifetime of the system you form a single binary is negligible. Okay, then. So why are there binaries in a galaxy? The answer must be that most of them were formed during the formation of the stars themselves. They are primordial binaries. So if you start a system the way I did in the demo just a moment ago, there were no binaries present. There were 600 particles in the demonstration, and that is so much bigger than the 10 or 20 or so that you require here that the probability for a binary star forming in the demonstration that I just gave to you is as close to zero as you would jolly well please. And therefore, the effect that I have just mentioned of the presence of a binary is not present. You just simply don't see it because it cannot be there. I didn't put it in. What I might do, and possibly I will do this in the future, is give the user of this computer code the possibility of putting by hand in a compact binary and then see what happens, right? But that's a different story altogether. To come back to the original point of the collision term, you see here how scalar estimates can give you an estimate of what I have graphically put on the blackboard over here, the interaction over a long stretch of space, and then an interaction of a jump in velocity that is easily managed, Right, so this is effectively a quantitative estimate of this Fokker-Planck effect, where this length scale is something like this B quantity that we had over here. All right, the impact parameter of a stellar encounter. And the deflection that we're talking about over here, this, is your delta V that we were talking about earlier. So you see already how these quantities sort of intertwine in a simple scalar estimate like this. And I've deliberately taken this scalar estimate from the book because it is so funny, because it tells us what the probability is of binary formation in an otherwise random stellar system. What remains to be done now is to be a little bit more focused, to see what we can do if we take this Fokker-Planck approximation here, impose it on the left-hand side of our distribution function equation, and see what we can then conclude about the evolution, in the long-term evolution in this case, of stellar systems.